Hi, everybody, and welcome to a Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is.
Carolina Bandinelli, and I work at the University of Warwick in the Centre for Cultural and Media Policy Studies.
Thank you for being here, Prof. Bandinelli. And for people outside Britain, Warwick is an impossible word to spell and say, right?
Yeah, totally. Also for me, to be honest, like the first, my one of my first days of work there, I attended one of these conferences aimed at, presenting the state of the arts of the university. And because Warwick is written like Warwick, and as an Italian, I say Warwick at my best, whereas they say Warwick. So what I understood back then was work as in WORK. So I was like, huh, they're very interested in work. And it was only like after an hour and a half that I understood that work is Warwick. So yeah, it
I
is an
love it. That's
impossible.
a wonderful story, and of course, particularly poignant because it's a century since E.P. Thompson was born, and he made Warwick a center of labor history. And he also published 50 years ago a book called Warwick Inc., which
I
was
know.
basically about the corporate commodification of the university. So there is a long history to work and
And
Warwick
Warwick.
being connected. That is
I
a great
think
story.
E.P. Thompson got it right. Unfortunately, I mean, as you know, now the commodification of academic work and knowledge and teaching is not only an issue of Warwick. It's quite widespread, at least here in the UK.
I think that's true. So, Prof, now that we've gotten over our requisite reference to E.P. Thompson and your wonderful example of homonyms or near homonyms, I wonder if you'd be prepared to share with us what are the things or what's the thing currently dynamizing, retarding, preoccupying, interesting you?
Well, recently I've written a novel and a personal essay in Italian. And at the same time, I've been working on my academic work. So what has interested me lately, one of the things that interests me is the hybridization of writing and academic writing, and whether there can be a way to write, intellectually sound or theoretically rich content, but in a way that is more literary or that hybridize with the personal history of the writer or of the academic. And of course, I'm not the first one to think of that. The obvious reference here is Virginia Woolf, Rooms of One's Own. But yes, it's interesting to see how, if I, after having written fiction in Italian, how I go back to my journal articles for academic journal in English, and vice versa. So, and also, of course, there's the aspect of going from one language to another and from one genre to another. And then, English becomes a little bit Italian, where it has always been for me, and Italian become anglicized, and academic writing become literary, and creative writing become intellectual and a little more abstract. And I think this is an interesting process. So I'm sort of on a journey, I suppose, probably one of those never-ending journeys, I hope, in which I'm trying to find a voice that can sort of hold together different registers. And I think this also stems from the fact that I've never believed or I've never loved an idea of academic work or intellectual work as this disembodied, objective, phallic in a way, mode of thinking and communicating. So I suppose there's also an epistemological aspect to all of that. So I think when it comes to my own sort of personal, intellectual and creative dimension, this is what has occupied me. It's niche, I realize, but
Well, I guess it's what Stephen Mukey and some others called ficto-criticism. But I'm thinking also of the genealogy of the Crónica in Spanish, which emerged from, or in part emerged from, the conquest of Latin America, and the fact that Cortés, leader of the Spanish conquest, kept a diary that was quite personal, but was infused with empirical data, census data about what they were doing. And that's become a lengthy tradition. Gabriel García Márquez would be the most famous exponent, which blends these things. I guess in Italy, Umberto Eco would be an example of a very successful novelist who was also a columnist in ways that were often quite personal. And a semiologist, and an essayist, right? I mean, would he be an example of this for you?
well, there's a joke that some of my friends and I make, which is whatever you think, you should know Umberto Eco has thought and written about it before. So the answer cannot be but yes. I mean, you've taken one of the greatest, I think, Italian intellectuals. And also another thing that I like of Umberto Eco is the fact that he's one of those, in a way, you would say highbrow intellectual, highbrow as in definitely very cultivated and accustomed also to an elitarian notion of culture, but at the same time, very interested and totally not afraid of popular culture, which is something that that again, it's part of this hybridization. Like, what do you do with the most refined philosophical or theoretical concept? Well, maybe you can watch Love Island and see what happens. So I suppose this is also why I identify as a cultural scholar in the tradition of cultural studies from the Birmingham Center, which in Italy is still something not very much, is not common at all. In fact, it is a bit unusual. And so that, yes, in that respect, I think definitely Umberto Eco is a model. And then I also think of Virginia Woolf, and I also think of many writers, mostly from the Anglophone world. Chris Krause is an example. Maggie Nelson is another example, but also Deborah Levy, as a fiction writer, but also in the living autobiography, in which there's memoir, there's fiction, but there's also some concept. It's very conceptual. So yeah, I'm interested in these aspects.
No, that's wonderful. Thank you for sharing that with us. And can you speak a little bit more about moving between the languages of Italian and English? You mentioned that in a very interesting way, saying that your Italian is becoming a bit more English and your English is becoming a bit more Italian, but there remains some kind of separation generically. Is that right?
Well, at a very sort of, I don't know, phenomenological level, my Italian becoming English could also mean that I write technology with an H and, unico, which means unique, with a Q instead of a C. And that's not great. Or, my accent. I'm someone that I was never interested in concealing my accent. I think there are two kind of foreign English speakers, those that try to sound native and those that don't. And yeah, maybe because I'm lazy, I decided that I'm one of those that sort of I claim and own my accent. When it comes to writing, I suppose when it comes to writing, my natural language now, my language of election is Italian with some sentences and some words that are in English. So for instance, when I wrote my novel in Italian, there are some parts that are in English. The same thing cannot be done, I suppose, the other way around. But it's also very different syntax because in Italian, if you want to write clever, you'll have very long paragraphs and a very complex syntax. I suppose it's the same in French and in Spanish, I think, but I know Spanish less. Whereas in English, if like clever prose or academic prose is more pragmatic and clear and rhythmic in a certain way. And I think in a way, sometimes this super virtuosism of any of sort of the cultivated Italian writing can result in a bit of a, I don't know, semiotic soup in which you're like, yes, but what do you mean? Whereas in the super clean, logical, you know, analytical, I'm thinking of the analytic philosopher. It's a bit like analytic versus continental philosophical paradigm. So in the Anglophone prose, sometimes, of course, I'm talking about intellectual academic essays work. Sometimes you lose the fact that a synonym or a certain musicality in the sentence can also reflect the content and the tone in a way that escapes the pure logical structure of an argument. So I suppose it's interesting to try and find and strike a balance in a way. But also, you know, moving between the two languages is sometimes you also translate yourself, which is something that I'm unable to do. So sometimes when I write something in Italian, I'm like, okay, I just need to translate myself or the other way around. And I'm unable to do it. It always emerges an adaptation because when I think in another language, other talks come to mind, like I think differently.
Examples I'm thinking of when it comes to very crisp, clear English prose would be Orwell and Chandler. And with Orwell, of course, you're getting somebody who is a journalist and a memoirist and a novelist. So he is combining these things, though not in an overtly academic way. And with Chandler and with Dashiell Hammett, for that matter, you get the distinctively utilitarian US contribution to this, which I think is some of the greatest prose or greatest writing in English since Shakespeare. And it can be very allusive, even though it's crisp and clear. Whereas when I read analytic philosophy, I get frustrated by the fact that the examples are always fabricated in
Yeah.
order to make them simpler.
The mental experiment, yeah.
Yes, and I feel the same way about neoclassical economics. I want to know about people working, people building, people living, people consuming. I don't want to know about a fantasy of how these things are arranged. So I think I hear what you're saying, and I think there is a lot that's lost if one can't have the rhythm and the alliteration and the allegory of language.
I suppose my target when I say that, of course, is not like Hemingway or Orwell, but I suppose one of the reason why I decided to do a bit of creative writing and write a novel is because I grew increasingly frustrated with academic, like the academic journal prose,
Yes.
especially in my field, which is cultural studies, sociology, and social sciences. I think in the pure humanities is different, but Don't you have the impression that sometimes, like, everybody writes with the same voice? Like, there's a standardization of the language and the structure that, in a way, it is useful or comfortable, because once you master that codes, then okay, your article gets published. I mean, regardless of what you're actually saying sometimes. But also, on the other hand, if you're someone that likes to write, it's dull. So yeah, I'm trying. Like, the last article that I published in the European Journal of Cultural Studies, it's very narrative. It's a story. Basically, I tell a story. And of course, this is something that has been done in ethnography. Again, it's not that nobody's reinventing the wheel, right? But I suppose that was also a way in which I sort of, I tried to bridge these different suggestions. I suppose it also has to do with maybe with my background or the story of, my intellectual or artistic story, because my first love was poetry and literature. And if you grew up in Florence in the 90s, you would study very classic things, so Dante and Leopardi and Petrarca. But then I studied philosophy, especially philosophy of science and analytic philosophy. But then I did a master in creative and cultural entrepreneurship, whatever it means. But my PhD was in cultural studies, media and cultural studies, and I did the thesis with an ethnographic method. So I think I've gone through different disciplines, and I'm always sort of suspicious. Or anyway, it's an affect, right? It gives it gives me a negative affective response. The fact that, okay, there are disciplines and they need to be different, I suppose I'm more led by curiosity, and one can be curious of different things
I
in
guess
different
one of the
ways.
things that one gets from reading someone like Bruno Latour is the notion that what appears to be an article in a science journal about, say, wind is certainly affected by the nature of wind as it is understood, but it can also be affected, and equally so, by the textual rules of the places where the work is published, and by the social forces that combine to make it p possible to investigate wind. And the idea that this is just, in a sense, a study of nature that purely emanates from observation or experimentation misses out on those elements of obeying textual rules and obeying social forces or fitting in with them. And that can lead to a very banal set of norms in the way of academic writing that can be very unfortunate. Then again, formulae have their own beauty.
Yeah.
I mean, I think of, say, Andrea Camilleri's novels
Oh.
that clearly have, a very set form, but have wonderful little variations that make each one worth reading. So generic rules aren't always, awful things, are they? They can be interesting
Oh.
guides and things to push against, no?
I mean, yeah, and also, if we go a little more kind of abstract, language is a set of generic rules that are completely arbitrary. So, I don't think there is a way to escape the codes, the norms, and the rule, but there is a way to mix and match, in a sense. There is a way of combining different rules. There is a way of playing around with them. And there is a way to just apply them in a sort of what can I say, automatic perhaps
Yeah,
way.
absolutely. Well, you've mentioned your recent article, and I wonder if we could talk a little bit now about areas of your research in greater detail.
Yeah,
And
sure.
like everybody probably who knows you study this, I want to learn about digital love and sex. But I wonder if we could start with fashion. And if you could tell us a little bit about your work on fashion, and perhaps along the way, help me understand the idea of creative industries and the idea of creative labor and what your take is on those concepts.
Well, that's a big question in a way. I don't know if I can help you understand creative industries. But I can definitely tell you what interests me. So what has interested me since my PhD, so I did my PhD on creative and social entrepreneurs. And what I investigated, and in a way, it's similar to what I investigated when I then look at fashion designers, is how people make sense of what could potentially be understood as different orders of values, different logics, different orders of words. So the creativity on the one hand and the industry on the other hand. I mean, creative industries at first to me sounded almost like a paradox. And I understand it as, on the one hand, at one level, I understand this as the ways in which creative processes and outputs gets formalized, structured, and organized as a form of work and as part of a wider economic structure. At another level is how people can pay their rent with their creative work, which is the same thing, but one is at systemic level and the other one is a subjective level. But what interests me as a researcher is how people make sense of it. What story do they tell themselves and how they resignify, for instance, entrepreneurship, the whole entrepreneurial ethos and values and rules and philosophy. You know, the vision of the world that is entailed in something like entrepreneurship with the vision of the world which is entailed in something like creativity as a signifier, as a whole imaginary attached to it. You know, when I moved from Florence to London and I had studied philosophy in Siena, which is a small town in Tuscany, it was a bit of an ivory tower. For me, the entrepreneur was Berlusconi, who was the premier back then. And so, for me, the idea of creative entrepreneurship or even cultural entrepreneurship just didn't make any sense. And I suppose my whole master and PhD was devoted to understand how people make sense of it. Like, what story do you tell yourself? And how do you combine different elements from different world vision, different philosophies, or because I use Foucault a lot in my work, I would call it regime of truth. So entrepreneurship, the whole idea of entrepreneurship has a certain regime of truth in which some actions are good, some talks are true, and some other actions are less good, and some talks are less good, less productive. And there is an implied ideal in the whole discourse around entrepreneurship. And when one talks about creativity, whether it is, you know, fashion or fine arts or creative writing. It's another world. There's another ideal status implied. So I'm interested in how people sort of navigate what in fact is a bit of a is a bit of an oxymoric oxymoric yeah is a bit of an oxymoron is a bit of a is a if you are a creative entrepreneur, like say if you are a young person who is creative and then at one point is told or realizes that the best way to make ends meet and to express your creativity is by acquiring an entrepreneurial ethos. And these can have different degrees. One can become an entrepreneur, as in setting up their own brand, or just embody an entrepreneurial ethos, as in looking at themselves as a capital to be invested, a la Beckett. And I'm here again referring to the Foucauldian understanding of the entrepreneurial self and society in the birth of biopolitics. So what kind of processes of subjectivations are at stake, and how people manage to respond to what may well be perceived as conflicting demands? Like, you have to be entrepreneurial, thus to think about yourself and to think about your interest and making a profit and being organized, and also do compromises, and also selling yourself and branding yourself and managing cash flows and business plans and talking to investors and do elevator pitches. But also, on the other hand, you are creative, you are free, you are an artist, you are an outsider. You don't care about what people think. You follow your own inspiration. And there's something in art and in creativity, or in a certain idea of art and creativity, that somehow escapes the financial logic, because also we can very well imagine something that is fantastic at the level of creativity or art, or even when I talk creativity, I think also intellectual work is very creative in its best instantiations. And that is not quantifiable. How can you quantify it? But the success of an entrepreneur is very much quantifiable. And so it's not that easy or granted how people navigate it, and also how people kind of, face challenges, also very practical challenges.
And thinking about this at the level of fashion, obviously, fashion is a set of industries or an industry that's got a very clear aesthetic hierarchy. And particularly in the post-Second World War period, that has had certain places, certain countries, the United States, Italy, France, Britain, as important nodes, even as much of the labor that makes these things is not entrepreneurial, not glamorous, and is ready to wear. And in fact, of course, many of these famous French or Italian names don't make their money from selling clothes, they make their money from selling perfume and associated toiletries. So one of your many achievements in this area, where I am pretty ignorant, is in co-authored work, a fairly recent book that looks at the fashion sector in different countries. And I wondered if you could tell us a wee bit about that, particularly your role in it.
Well, you are referring to the fashion as creative economy, which I co-authored with Angela McCrobbie and Dan Stratt. And that is the outcome of a ethnographic empirical research that took place in London, Berlin, and Milan. It's not a comparative study, but we look at different cities. Now, the way my role in it was basically to do the ethnography in Milan. And what what we looked at were not the big brand. You know, we didn't look mostly at Gucci. We weren't concerned with Armani or with Alexander McQueen or Stella McCartney, but rather with the micro enterprises. So mostly we looked, and definitely for the Milan part, I looked at independent fashion designers. And what one of the findings that we talk about in our work is that in fact these two worlds are pretty separate, and they are separate not only in terms of the place they occupy in the whole fashion ecosystem or the, economy of fashion, meaning that, the big brands are part of the two main groups, and they are like, quoted, they have financial quotes, they're all part of the financial economy at the global level, whereas fashion, and micro entrepreneurs, they sew clothes in their bedrooms and sell it on Etsy. So definitely there is a different, there are like two very different worlds. But also, and this is what I am interested in, or what where my focus lie is, that they're also very different in terms of values. In fact, most of the fashion entrepreneurs I talk with, these micro entrepreneurs or one person enterprises, you can call it in different ways, they decided, well, there are two things. Firstly, is that it is not easy to find a good job in the fashion world. Most of the jobs, entry-level jobs, are highly exploitative. And there's a book by Giulia Menzieri, which is very good about it, about, I think, is the story of an intern at a big fashion brand. So they are characterized by the long hours, exploitative mechanisms, unpaid internships, precarious work. And also they are scarce. So unemployment is a very concrete possibility for a graduate in fashion or someone that wants to work in fashion. But also on the other hand, most of the people I talk to, well, actually all, they would say that they do not want for this, they do not want to work and be part of this system because it is a corrupted system, because the big brands like big fashion is elitarian, as in who can actually buy a Gucci outfit. It is very exclusionary because who can fit in a Gucci outfit? Who can wear it? What body is a Gucci body? What pockets are Gucci pockets? And it is unsustainable. I mean, fashion is one of the most unsustainable industries. So there is an imaginary, there is an ethic attached to fashion micro entrepreneurs, which through which they differentiate their work from the fashion brand. So they would, for instance, in the Berlin chapter of the book, Angela McRobbie talks about the social entrepreneurs, the fashion designer and social entrepreneurs in Berlin. And for instance, in Milan, one of the person I interviewed, she was working on clothes for different bodies, for bodies that are not conventional. And also in terms of age, for instance, if you look at the fashion world, they are all 25. I mean, what about people who are older, especially women who are older than 25? Are we supposed to go around naked? Not even. Nobody wants to see us naked after after a certain age. So I think that that's very interesting. And also there's an acknowledgement of the unsustainability, like social, economic, and environmental of the fashion industry. So for instance, typically independent fashion designers would try to source their material in a sustainable way, would not outsource labor in the global south, in which labor is much cheaper. So they would try to do things in a very sustainable way, but then they were very pricey. So if you go and shop for, a super sustainable thing made by an ethical designer that lives next door and blah blah blah, then it's gonna cost you a lot. And if you go to H&M or Primark or Zara for that matter, whatever, it's gonna cost you a lot less. So this is also, the paradox of what some call the ethical consumerism. And what on the level of a cultural critique, I think it is interesting how, and this is something that I've written in my book, in my monographic book, which is called Social Entrepreneurship and Neoliberalism, and also in a few articles that I wrote, is how, the ethical and political dimension is collapsed at the level of the individual. So, okay, the world is unsustainable, so I'll do something sustainable. But also, on the other hand, it is interesting how a fully individualized neoliberal subjectivity tries to re-embed a social and ethical dimension in their activities. But also how the social and ethical dimension is not something that sits aside work. Like, okay, I'm employed somewhere in an office, in a factory, in a company, and then I'm an activist. I'm part of associations or political organizations, but the two conflate. So work in the creative industries typically acquires a very identitarian and totalizing significance, meaning, so that it has to reflect and embed and become like the channel through which ethical and political values and ideals are affirmed, and it needs to be profitable. I mean, people need to pay their rent and bills. So it's a lot, it's a big ask to oneself.
Prof Bandinelli, I wonder if to conclude, I could ask you one more question and then throw it over to you to add anything that you'd like to by way of conclusion. Does that sound all right as a means of
Sure.
bringing things to a close? So, when I was young, a very popular record was called Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And similarly, before I was born, Alfred Hitchcock's film Rear Window came out, and there's a character in it called Miss Lonely Hearts, who convenes each night in her lounge room, in her dining area of her apartment, a dinner set for two with a candle and a bottle of wine in a way where it's romantic, but there's no other person there. And when I was 19,
That's a
20,
good reference.
in college and so on, nobody I knew was in a Lonely Hearts Club that you joined by writing into a newspaper normally. And if they were, they didn't talk about it. You look at this phenomenon in great detail, you and some co-authors, in the digital era where no one is ashamed, it seems, about going online to find love. I was at a birthday party the other day where someone was rapping about the people in the room, and he said of me, Toby Miller, he's always on Tinder. So,
Is that true? You're not meant to answer this question.
I'm interested in how there's been this motion from something that was slightly pathetic and laughable, as in Rear Window or the Beatles, to something that is both ordinary but as you and your authors show, has strange connections to governmentality, subjectification, and cathexis, psychoanalytic projection and introjection.
Yeah. I've written a few articles on these. On this topic, as you know, with different co-authors and a single author one, but it is important for me to mention, as you did, that most of these articles are like joint ventures, because I wanted to look at it from different perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
So one with Arturo Bandinelli, who's also my brother, we looked at it from a Lacanian perspective. And then with Alessandro Gandini, we look at it from a perspective of economic sociology. And with Alberto Cossu, we look at the phenomenon more from, a sociological and also kind of from a digital sociology perspective, perhaps, I would say. And then in my single author one, it was full-on cultural studies, and that's it. How to answer your question? Well, I would have a lot of things to say. Also, the personal essay that I published in Italian is called Le Post-Romantiche, which means the post-romantic. So, you're right. In a way, if you were part of a Lonely Hearts Club, or even if you were part on the, or if you subscribed on one of the early dating sites, so not apps, but websites like meetic.com, you were a bit of a loser. There was a social stigma attached to it. Like what everybody would think was, okay, this person has no other means to find someone, or, you know, in quotation marks, to get laid. This is what was the common thought. Apps have changed this. And this has to do, I believe, with the particular technology and the cultural and social roles that apps have acquired. So, to what media scholars call the platformization of life, because apps have platformized pretty much everything, and everything has become an app, has taken the form of an app. Well, almost everything, but we have an app for, you know, waking up in the morning, falling asleep at night. There's an app to get us food. There's an app to get us from A to B. There's even an app to monitor your period, if you have a period. And there is an app to monitor your health, and so on and so forth. And so, in a way, I think the platformization of life has made the fact that you look for love very similar to, well, I look for a pizza, I look for love, I look for the next train. It's contiguous. The whole inhabit your phone. It's the same gestures. It's uniformizes. And then there's another aspect, which is the promotional narrative of dating apps, which reflects the technological solutionism. I'm using here a concept from Morozov. The technological solutionism, which is central to the digital culture. So dating apps said, look, we found the solution. You've always struggled to find love, haven't you? You've struggled to have sex. You've struggled to find a partner. But now there's a dating app. So now you can finally have access to a virtually infinite pool of partners. It is about maximizing opportunities. And in what Eva Illouz called postmodern love or capitalist love, opportunities are key. Because since the aftermath of the sexual revolution, love became a matter of choosing. You need to choose the right person. But it's a mess to choose the right person, especially because if you go for the wrong one, then it's your fault, then it's a failure. And that's why, to use the title of one of Eva Illouz's book on the topic, this is why love hurts. So in a way, dating apps say, look, we help you to choose. There's an algorithm. One slogan of one of these dating apps is, we found the brain behind the butterfly. The algorithm becomes this object that can finally rationalize the enigmatic, chaotic, messy matter of choosing, recognizing a partner. And also, it gives you the possibility to try or evaluate or assess many. So this is what dating apps tell. They tell you, we have found the solution. We cracked it. This is what apps tell you in general. You cannot sleep. Well, we cracked it. Now there is this guided meditation and you'll fall asleep in 10 minutes. In my experience, that's not true. You know, once, okay, this is a digression, but once I listened to one of these stories to sleep, and it was about imagine you are in a forest and you're alone and it's all dark. Come on. This is scary. I mean, nobody will fall asleep. You have to be wide awake if you are in that situation. But what, I mean, to really kind of encapsulate in one sentence, one of the main findings of my research on dating apps is that the apps don't work. Dating apps don't work. In fact, they are good to not meeting anybody because, when you are of, yeah, the usual disclaimer that I need to do, in when I talk about this is, yes, people do find partners on dating apps. I have friends who are married and have kids and they met on Tinder. There are Tinder babies and Tinder weddings, and that's amazing. But there are also a lot of people who are on the app to perform the labor of dating, to perform a self that is there, that is on top of their dating life, that is active in the dating scene. But this can be done also without meeting anybody. The apps, dating apps, do something even without the embodied encounter. You can match. And matching is a sign in itself. You know, when I did the research, I downloaded Tinder and I stayed there for a couple of months. And when I matched with people, I was like, okay, and now they're going to message me and then we're going to go out because they like me. And one of my research participants, in fact, the research participants was like, no, you are thinking in an offline mode. A match is a match. It doesn't have anything to do with the fact that then, you know, they really want to see you or they'll text you. So a match is a sign of likability in itself. And it is part of the whole reputational economy attached to the dating scene so that you are cool, you are likable. And for this reason, and in this way, they are able to engage the desire of the subject, of the users. They offer a way in which the subject can negotiate with their own desire and desirability without the encounter, because the encounter is scary. And it is scary because you encounter another. It is scary because there is the body. It is scary because sex is difficult. It is scary because then you may end up in a toxic relationship. It is scary because, you know, you may be traumatized. It is scary because you can be rejected. But also there is this demand, you know, there is this social demand, this imperative that has been around for a while, since the 80s, 90s, and depends what part of the world. Of course, it's a very Western perspective. And the imperative is you got to have a lot of dates and have a lot of sex and be adventurous and experiment because then you'll be able to find the right one. But this doesn't work exactly, you know, like this. I'm not saying it was better before or there is a way in which love works. Love doesn't work. It's not like the whole ideology of efficiency cannot be applied to love. So yes, I would say the app don't work the way they are supposed to work. And if you think about it from a business perspective, this is very obvious because if an app would work, then a dating app would work, then you wouldn't need it anymore, right? So they sort of need not to work. But from a cultural perspective, it's very interesting also how they are creating new codes when it comes to love and sex, or remediating existing codes. And well, I could get on talking about this for hours, so you need to stop me at some point, or to help me narrow it down.
Well, I tell you what you've done for me is that next time I hear the Verve singing, I'll be listening to a song that is actually, but the apps don't work, they just
Exactly.
make you worse.
Totally.
That's what you're telling
Yeah,
me.
that's my reference. The apps don't work is totally Verve. I own it to the Verve. Yeah, totally. You spotted it.
And Prof. Carolina, I wonder if there is something or there are some things you'd like to add to what we've discussed. You've been very generous in teaching me a great deal this afternoon. But are there things we didn't touch on that you'd like to mention, or things we did discuss but where you'd like to add something?
Well, I don't know. No, I think I've said enough, and I hope maybe we can have other occasions to talk. And I've written about this stuff, so maybe if someone is interested, yeah, they can go and have a read. But yeah, lately, because I started from dating apps, but what I'm really interested in is to try and capture and what is the emerging structure of feeling when it comes to love and sex. And I think that we live in what I call this post-romantic society, and the new utopia or dystopia is that of love that don't hurt. It's what Alain Badiou calls love without default, is love devoid of risk and trauma and turned into an efficient matchmaking. So I don't know whether this resonates or not, but the next thing I want to write is about that. I want to sort of try to describe what I think is the emerging structure of feeling when it comes to love and sex, because I think that things are changing, that we are in a moment of a reformation of the realm of love and sex, in which there's a new politics and a new ethics attached to it, and a new imaginary and utopia.
That's quite a task, and it sounds like a fascinating next project. So thank you so much, Prof. Bandinelli. It's been wonderful talking to you.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.